TFM.
Welcome, Boomers, to another episode of Warp 5, our dedicated Enterprise podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, I don't want to scare you, but don't turn around. Duras is behind you.
Again? I thought we took care of that guy.
Yeah, he just keeps popping up. But, you know, this might be the last time. We'll find out as we continue our 20th anniversary rewatch of Star Trek Enterprise. And today we're going to be talking about the final episode of Season 2, The Expanse. And here is a quick rundown of the story. An attack on Earth by an unknown species forces Starfleet to call the NX-01 back and presents the crew with a new mystery, one filled with danger greater than anything humanity has faced. Tipped off by Future Guy that a species called the Zindi are behind the attack, Archer has to convince Admiral Forrest and Starfleet to let him go find these unknown bad guys. Meanwhile, Trip faces the loss of his sister, killed in the attack, and T'Pol finds herself once again caught between worlds. And if that wasn't enough, Duras and the Klingons are at it again. So, Matthew, I think that's a good place to start, actually, with the Klingons, because this episode, it's sort of clearing the deck, right? We're going to make this big change of direction for the series, and we've got some loose ends to tie up here before we send the crew into unknown space. One of those being the Klingons, and we also have the Suliban pop up. We've got Future Guy. We've got Vulcans who once again think that humans aren't ready to go out and do things on their own. So it feels a little bit like they're bringing it all together to tear it all apart here to wrap up the original concept of the show.
Yeah, I do find this to be really interesting. The fact that there is every single part of the first season of Enterprise and the second season of Enterprise. Specifically, I was thinking too, you know, we didn't even mention the kind of the resolution of the story there with T'Pol as a character as well. The fact that, you know, she didn't want to be a part of this in the first place. She was not happy about being on Enterprise. And now we've gotten to this place where she wants to stay. And so, you know, I find that just to be incredibly interesting that every single piece of what they've been doing here in the last 2 years is trying to come together in this episode so that, like you said, we can branch off now into a different storyline. And it is one of those things, too, which I find to be really interesting because, and I guess there's no other way to put this other than the fact that it really is, in many ways, kind of the downfall of the episode. Because there's just so much that they are, I think, trying to do here. I'm a little surprised in some ways that this didn't get turned into like a two-parter to try and, you know, be able to have them go home, be able to have them to deal with all the losses, be able to deal with the refit, be able to, I mean, you know, there's a lot of time that passes in this episode because not only do they travel home, which takes them quite a while to get there, but of course, they have to go, you know, all the way to the Expanse. So it takes them like 6 months to get there. So there's just a lot of storyline that kind of happens that we don't really see. And it's almost like there's just the snapshots of what's been going on to try and get us there. And then, you know, at the same time, you're bringing in the Klingons and the Suliban and Future Guy and everything like that. And in some ways, it almost feels like that storyline, you get the sense that you might never touch it again and that it could be the end of that storyline maybe. And then with the Klingons, you know, with Duras' ship being destroyed there, it's like, okay, well, that storyline has most likely come to an end at that point, at least as it stood. And so, yeah, I mean, I just find that to be, you know, incredibly interesting.
Well, there is a point where Archer mentions that they've been traveling at warp 5 for 7 weeks as they get close to the expanse. So that's about almost 2 months of traveling, which made me think, can the ship really sustain warp 5 for 7 weeks? Because typically in Star Trek, the top speed, if you think about the Enterprise D, it couldn't sustain warp 9.9 for all that long, right? Mm-hmm. So here we've got the NX-01 at its maximum speed for 7 weeks. Okay. I'm not sure. Maybe he meant most of the time we were at warp 5. But as far as the Klingons go, yeah, it felt like, I think they knew, we're not going to touch this story again. And we need to resolve it somehow. So let's just get it out of the way. Mm-hmm. Because when you see the attack on Earth, and then you come back in and you cut to the Klingons talking about Archer, and you feel a little bit like, okay, this is a bit of a disconnect in terms of the story. You don't necessarily feel that way the first time you watch it. But once you know what the story is and then what mm-hmm. it turns into, it feels a bit like, okay, why are we spending time on this? Like you said, when there's so much other stuff going on. But at the same time, if they had never resolved the Klingons pursuing Archer, mm-hmm. would you have felt like something was missing from the series? Or would you have been fine with, well, the last time he got away, that's it. And the Klingons decided, you know, we can't catch that guy. Let's just leave him alone.
It's interesting because, you know, when you think back to the last few episodes of this season, you know, the Klingons have been a part of this. You know, you had Bounty right before this. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, I understand the inclination to want to kind of wrap up this story. Mm-hmm. And I think that, again, maybe a two-parter would have been really interesting to have this storyline kind of fit in better. Because in some ways, what they're dealing with Duras just a few days ago, before, you know, they get the news of what happened, had been on the forefront of their minds. You know, now it almost doesn't even matter to them, right? Because what's happening with Duras and the Klingons that follow him, it's just almost like a nuisance. Mm-hmm. And so to me, I think that's the thing that I find really interesting about this. And it's one of those places where I just wish it could have been expanded more, because I think that would have been a great story point mm-hmm. to have them kind of be frustrated in the sense, like, we don't have time to deal with this because we got bigger fish to fry. You know, we got bigger Zindi to hunt. So, mm-hmm. and you're just in our way, and we don't care about you in that way. Like, just so I think that's the thing with that. I mean, the other part of the story with the Suliban and Future Guy, in some ways that makes complete sense, because of course that's going to tie into where they go in the third season with the Zindi themselves, and how this kind of wraps into the actual temporal Cold War story. So that, mm-hmm. I think, fits pretty perfectly, especially with the knowledge that we have now, knowing that that's all going to play.
Mm-hmm. Well, and even on a first viewing, that makes sense, because Future Guy would have the knowledge to tip Archer off as to what's going on. And let him know, okay, well, there are these guys called the Zindi, and in the future, their world is destroyed, or they think their world's going to be destroyed anyway, by humans, and so they're coming after you. You need someone who can see across time to deliver that information, and because Future Guy is already so well established in the story of Enterprise, it makes sense to use him here in that way. So, yeah, I thought that worked fine. On a first viewing, you have to wonder, is this the last time we're going to see Future Guy? Because before you head into season 3 and you don't know what the story is going to be and how it's going to be tied into the temporal Cold War, you might think that just like they're putting the Klingons to bed, they're also putting the Suliban and the temporal Cold War storyline to bed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I mean, I think you make a great point. It is one of those things, as you watch this episode, you do kind of think, okay, all of these storylines were we're pushing to the side in some ways, and we're making room for this new direction that we're going. You know, I do think that it's also interesting because, again, you deal with the choice of DePaul, and that's a whole other storyline that we've been watching throughout the last few seasons. The last two seasons have been so much about her kind of becoming part of this crew in a way that makes her kind of indispensable. And I find that to be just incredibly interesting that, you know, we get her choice of saying, no, I'm going to stay with you. I was in some ways it's interesting because she's basically like, I was put here against my will, but now she almost believes like I was put here for a reason. You know, it's almost like this, that she has come to believe in fate, that she's been placed here for such a time as this, which is an incredibly interesting character arc for somebody who couldn't stand humans at the beginning of the show.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, well, talking about DePaul, we have it later on the outline, but now's a good time to talk about that a little bit more. I think that she's become, like, I think she feels like she's part of this family on the ship. And it surprises her, I'm sure, because like you said in the beginning, go back to Broken Bow and the early episodes after that, she was on the ship, but she didn't really want to be there. She grew to become closer to some of the character, some of her crewmates, but Archer in particular, she and Archer have come to have a lot of respect for one another and to work well together. And I'm sure that that played a big part in her decision to stay. And I also think if you think about someone who leaves the nest, you know, kids leaving home as they grow up, or someone who leaves their hometown maybe when they're older and goes out to other parts of the world and makes a new life somewhere, you start to find yourself outside of the community or the framework or the beliefs or whatever that you've grown up in or that you've become entrenched in. And I think that's kind of the case with T'Pol, where when we see her in Broken Bow, you know, she's just part of the Vulcan society and the military structure and all of this. And she has this one view of humans, but now that she's spent so much time with them, she's sort of developed her own view of things. And when she hears these things from Saval and she's being given orders by the high command that you have to come back and you're going to be part of the Ministry of Information now and such, she's thinking, well, that's not who I am anymore. Right? I don't want to give up the life of who I am now. I have my own identity.
Well, and I think that one of the most interesting parts about that conversation that they have, too, is, you know, he tells her, you've been away too long. You've been around humans for too long. And so in many ways, you get this sense that the Vulcan High Command sees that she has become too human and becoming too human. And that in some ways, I think, worries them. And so you can get the sense of as to why they are bringing her, why they are recalling her, because they don't like basically what they're seeing in her becoming too human. And I think that's you know, having too many human tendencies. So I do find that to be incredibly interesting with her character. And like you said, it's also one of the beauties of, and this is, I think this is very Star Trek in this sense, right? Is that as you spend time with people, you begin to understand them and you begin to be able to put yourself in their shoes. You be able to have, you know, you can have empathy for them. And I think that's the thing that we've seen in T'Pol. You know, you get a lot of humanity kind of rubbing off on her in a way that she never would have expected. And I think in the best way, right? Like she's learned to care about people other than just Vulcans, you know, and we see that's an incredibly hard choice for many Vulcans to make. They have such a superiority complex with other species that they find it very difficult to get along with them, you know? Mm. And it's one of the things to which, you know, Roddenberry's Star Trek, humanity having moved past many of these things, is able to help these other species that haven't had to do that, you know? And I think that's, it's one of the problems sometimes of Star Trek is because we deal with too many of the cultures monolithically.
Yeah.
And humanity is treated in a non-monolithic sense. And that's what got it to the place of being able to learn how to work together. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. And, you know, in some ways, I think this, again, points to the fact that these Vulcans and Enterprise have a place to go to. You know, we've got a story arc that's coming for them. And T'Pol is actually the avatar of that storyline in the sense that she's the microcosm of the macrocosm that's happening with the Vulcans, which is incredibly interesting and I think in many ways well done. So,
Yeah. The Vulcan, the high command, they're not concerned about her safety, which is implied by a lot of the video footage they show of what happened to Vulcans who went into the Expanse. It's more like you said, I think, that they don't like the fact that she's becoming so human. So with all of these elements, in particular, we'll talk about this a little bit later on, but while we're still close enough to your suggestions that the story would have been better served by being a two-parter, so they have a little bit more time, I think that if this episode were made in today's television environment with streaming, they would have simply made the episode about an hour and 10 minutes, something like that.
Sure, yeah.
And it would have just been one episode, but it would have had the breathing room needed to tell the Klingon story, have a little bit more behind the Suliban and Future Guy. So it's not just the Suliban showing up to escort Archer to Future Guy.
Right.
But there would be something a little bit more to it. And we probably would have gotten more of T'Pol's inner workings to go along with her decision. So shifting gears to another topic, of course, we have to talk about this reflection of the times. Star Trek has always been a reflection of the times, and this third season storyline came about after the 9/11 terrorist attacks on New York and Washington. And besides the obvious parallel of a major attack happening and a lot of people being killed, there's also the fact that the United States was feeling vulnerable in a way that it had never felt vulnerable before after those attacks, because the U.S. had seen itself as pretty much being impenetrable to outside forces because of the geography of the country and the difficulty of launching an actual attack on U.S. soil. And suddenly it felt like, wow, you know, this could happen other places in the country. Mm-hmm. You know, we're at risk now. And then in addition to that fear, there was also this resolute attitude of, we're going to defend ourselves and we're going to go find who did this and we're going to hold them responsible for it. And we see all of that here, where Earth feels vulnerable in a way that they haven't. And what's interesting is Starfleet seems to have the attitude a bit of, well, let's kind of sit back and see what's going to happen here. But Archer, because of what he knows, and Tripp, because of the loss of his sister, in particular, feel like, no, we've got to take action. We've got to go do something.
Right.
So how do you feel this works within Star Trek? Did they sufficiently wrap real-world events in a way that works for Star Trek storytelling, which has been done all the way back to the original series? Or do you feel like this was a little bit more transparent, a little bit more ripped from the headlines than we're accustomed to for Star Trek?
I mean, you know, I don't think that it is that different than having two characters on screen, and one has a right-sided white face, and the other one has a left-sided white face.
Yeah.
I think...
pretty obvious, right?
Yes, exactly. And I think in this, some ways this is obvious, but, I, you know, as I'm rewatching this again, of course, one of the things that I noticed is that they set up the complete difference in this situation, though, in that the Zindi have been told that Earth would attack them in the future. And so they've been manipulated from the very beginning. And I think... in some ways, that creates a bit of a difference, right? You know, we could go down a whole semantical route that we're not going to about, you know, how and why and everything happened for 9/11. But I think that they planted the seeds already of the way in which this is going to turn out differently than we expect, and that there's a true villain behind things that aren't the Zindi, right? And I think the question that they're raising in this episode specifically is, will these characters who have been through an enormous amount of trauma, and I do mean, when I say that, real trauma, you know, Trip losing his sister and his hometown and everything like that, other people in Starfleet, and just the like you said, the vulnerability that you would feel when your planet is attacked like this, will they be able to put that aside and listen if these people weren't really responsible, if there's somebody else responsible? And I think to me, as I, you know, watch now with the foresight that we have of what's coming, I think it's actually a better storyline than just being a one for one. But I do think that in many ways it's something that is incredibly and was incredibly cathartic for people to kind of work through that at the time, and even to watch at the time, right? And so I don't necessarily have a problem with it, you know, and Battlestar Galactica, which gets so much praise, the newer version, was very much a response to 9/11 as well. I mean, this could sound heretical to many people, but I've rewatched Enterprise Season 3 many more times than I've watched Battlestar Galactica, which I've seen twice. And that's because I end up liking the storyline and the show better from start to finish. I think Season 3 does this a really good job in the end. And so, you know, I don't really necessarily mind that we've got this big thing happening and we need to find a way to deal with it. And one of our best ways to do that is through story. So,
I think a difference between Enterprise Season 3 and Battlestar Galactica in the sense that you're mentioning here is that with Enterprise, we're dealing with a single season, one straight storyline. And with Battlestar Galactica, because of the multiple seasons, they sort of evolved that story. And then I know towards the end, it gets a little bit odd, I guess is one way of putting it, or a little bit out there anyway. I love the series, but I know what you mean. And I know that, you know, some people love the earlier parts of it more than the later parts. But at any rate, I think for this story and the question that I asked, I think that the proximity to the events of 9/11 when this first aired, it was about a year and a half later, made it really feel much more like a response or a reaction to that attack. And you could see the parallels a lot more clearly. But as time goes on, I think the story that we have here fully stands on its own as a very interesting Star Trek story. And the setup of it in The Expanse, the attack on Earth, it's a standard event that could happen in the Star Trek universe, completely independent of any inspiration like the 9/11 attacks. And so when you watch it here now 20 years later, as we are, while we know what inspired the direction of the story in some senses, it doesn't necessarily color the way you watch it now. You can watch it just as it's a season of Star Trek. Here are some events that happen in the Star Trek universe. And so for me, because of that, yeah, I don't feel like it's something that we would sometimes on television call a ripped from the headlines type of show, season, storyline, because every story is inspired by something, right? And most often those inspirations have some root in the real world and things that have happened to us. So, I think it works fine. And I think they wrapped it as well as Star Trek has over the years with anything.
Well, and I think too, I mean, again, speaking with the future in mind, I think that this storyline also goes to show why other events then have this chain reaction, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the Romulans think it's time to be able to take on Starfleet, think they're weakened, you know, all this stuff. You know, you're dealing with things from Star Trek history, like Colonel Green and Terra mm-hmm. Prime stuff going on. And like, so the other part of this, I think, that's incredibly interesting is the way that they're able to utilize then Star Trek history to tie this all together. And that this is kind of a catalyst event for all that, right? Mm-hmm. And when you think about it too, it's far enough in the history that, you know, if it doesn't get name dropped in the other series, especially by the time you get to the Next Generation and beyond, it's like, well, that's a long time ago. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. you know, we don't name drop, I feel like, Roman emperors every day, you know? Yeah, maybe once in a while, but, you know, I think that's something that to me, when I reflect on this storyline as a reflection of the times, I also reflect on the storyline as a reflection of what's happening at that time period in Star Trek and what would happen, kind of what we had gathered from the other series that happened in between the rest of it. And mm-hmm. I think they make all that work. So
mm-hmm. I assume you're referring to everyday conversation, except for those little Caesar's pizza commercials, right?
Of course. I mean, yeah, those yeah. are, I mean, of course, that's happening all the time. So,
but no, this is a good point, because the next thing that we have here to talk about is injecting the unknown into Star Trek history. And the way that you framed it there really makes a lot of sense, because Enterprise was always tiptoeing around canon. We've got things like we encounter Romulans, but we don't know who they are, and their name's never mentioned is one example. The Borg and the fact that they don't actually use the name and they don't know who they are. So there's all these ways of tiptoeing around history, with the show being a prequel to the original series. And here, they're just injecting this entirely unknown species, a major traumatic event inflicted on Earth and on Starfleet that we've never heard of before. And so for a lot of fans, that's really hard to wrap their mind around, because surely we would have known about this and it would have been referenced later on. But yeah, like you say, 200 years from now, just because we don't hear about it on screen doesn't mean that the people themselves, the characters for us watching the show, the people in the actual universe, the fictional universe, it doesn't mean that they don't know that all this stuff happened. It just means they don't sit around talking about it. They don't bring it right. up, right? I mean, if you and I get together for a beer or some whiskey, like you said, we're not going to mm-hmm. be having a conversation about Roman emperors, right? We're going to be, you know, talking about Star Trek probably, but at least something yeah. else that's more contemporary, right? So, and very good point that you made is the fact that they do at least leverage this to make it the trigger for other events in history that we do know about. The xenophobia, you mentioned Colonel Green, these types of things. And if you were to wonder, well, in history, why did Earth go down this path? We all know about Khan, but what were the other things? Well, if we want to add texture to it, we want to trace it back, this is a good way to do it.
Yeah. I mean, I think in many ways, this is one of those places where the show is doing the best it can with the position it's in. Mm-hmm. And I think too, it does very much help that I know what's coming next. You know, I'm not just mm-hmm. watching this as is, as we all were back in the day. Mm-hmm. And I think they do a good job, you know, and it shows too. And I think this is the other thing is that, you know, I believe that in season three, Manny Coto would come on in the background before mm-hmm. he becomes the showrunner in season four. And so in many ways, I think he is starting to kind of lay the seeds for where he wants to go and everything and trying to make all of this work. And again, I think they do. And, you know, I think that I guess the thing it comes down to is I just don't have a problem with it. Mm-hmm. You know, and part of that is because I do know where we're going. And I do remember when this series was going, it was like, okay, well, this is interesting. I was willing to give it the benefit of the doubt. And so, and I think, you know, we have to do that with everything that we're watching, you know, in the same way I feel like that I've been able to try to give Strange New Worlds the benefit of the doubt because it's trying to do much of the same thing. And I think, as we've talked about that show, we found places to be, I think, pretty critical where what they're doing is truly, we can't seem to reconcile, right? This, though, it's like it never crosses the line where I can't reconcile it, especially because, again, it's like 200 years then past, you know, all Deep Space Nine and, you know, all those shows. So it's, again, I think that's the thing that makes this work for me mm-hmm. in the sense that there isn't anything that stands out to where it's like, okay, this is this and this is this. Those things can't sit side by the side in the same universe. You know, mm-hmm. that's not happening. And that's mm-hmm. happened with some of the newer Star Trek shows, but that isn't happening here. Mm-hmm. And so with that, I mean, you know, it might not be the perfect fit for everyone, but I don't think we could say that it's too much.
Yeah. And speaking of the position it's in, not just on the timeline, but the position it was in on TV in production when it was being written and the tugging going on from the network and so forth that influenced the direction and the writing. I do think that they were doing the best that they could here, and I think they did quite well in setting this up. So one other thing to talk about, we talked about T'Pol a bit. I wanted to talk about Trip and Trip's loss. And one thing that I've heard in the past, which I find a bit odd, is that some people felt that Trip's reaction to everything was a little bit over the top. I don't know if that's because they felt that he was over the top as a human looking at the situation, or if they felt like for his character as it had been presented over two seasons up to that point, didn't quite jive with the Trip that we were seeing here, where he's so emotional and he's so angry. And he talks to Reed and, you know, he tells Reed, we got to get this weapons ready and we're going to get these people. I think even if that's the case, that the view is that the character felt off, I think the situation would probably throw you off and change you very quickly as a person.
I mean, look, I don't have any issue with this at all. I think, you know, and I think it's completely consistent with the character of Trip. I would argue that, you know, till my dying day, honestly. Mm-hmm. I just don't understand how anybody could see that because, you know, mm-hmm. Trip has learned a lot since he's been out in space. But now something that he never, ever, ever thought would happen, his family being attacked and his baby sister dying on Earth, mm-hmm. has happened. And I think anybody who's lost anyone will tell you, especially unexpectedly, that changes a person. And it can mm-hmm. change a person drastically, and it can do it for the better or for the worse, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that the thing that it does wonderfully, too, in the series. Again, it gives us somewhere to go with the character. It keeps him dynamic instead of getting flat. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, think about how Picard reacts in Star Trek generations when he loses his brother and his nephew. I mean, and there's nothing to be angry at other than the fact that they were burned in a fire, but it causes emotional trauma to the nth degree for him. I mean, he almost isn't able to save the galaxy because he's so caught in his depression over this unexplainable thing happening, right? Mm-hmm. And so
that's something that we've talked about probably on the Ready Room when we talked about generations. And I think you and I have probably talked about it on the Artificial Tango when we were talking about probably in season two, I think. But that was a case where also viewers at the time thought, well, Picard's out of character. Picard would never act this way. But you would in that situation.
Yeah. I mean, I can't see how. Again, to me, Tripp's reaction to this seems utterly consistent with the character and makes complete sense to me as to why he would react this way.
Yeah, yeah, same for me. All right, well, a final thing to talk about here is stuff that's not in the episode, because earlier, well, you were talking about how the episode needed more breathing room. Maybe it should have been a two-parter. And as I said, in today's world, it would have just been longer so they could fit everything in. The script for this was running about 10 minutes long, so they had to cut time because, of course, back then, you had to nail within a few seconds the running time of a show so the commercials could fit in, so they've got to take stuff out. So I assume that they trimmed, pruned here and there, tightened things up, but they also cut about 5 minutes out of the episode. They cut two scenes. One involved Archer meeting a love of his on Earth, who we've never heard of before, in a Chinese restaurant. And the other involved Hoshi appearing to be leaving the ship, but then Archer finds out that she's going to stay. So my question for you, and let's do these one scene at a time, should these have been left in the episode? Would the episode have been better with them, or was cutting them the right thing to do regardless of time? So starting with Archer in the Chinese restaurant, what do you think about that scene?
Yeah, I think that the scene does not work. Everything about it just doesn't work. I mean, part of it too is that there's no sound effects going on. It's just the vocal performance too.
And it's
just
devoid of energy as well.
There's no energy. I think it would have been really different if they had like Erica Hernandez there had been the love interest, right?
I think
that would have been phenomenal. And then you would have been like, oh, why'd you cut that? This just, it doesn't work, and it doesn't make sense really, because it doesn't seem to fit with the character of Archer and what we know of him. Mm-hmm. This is like, okay, talk about things that don't fit. It's like everything we've sensed from Archer here is that he's available, right? Mm-hmm. Like he doesn't have a sweetheart at home. And so this scene, I think in that sense, just doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, I'm glad they cut the scene. As I just said, it's devoid of energy in the first place. The acting is not good. Bakula's fine, but even Bakula he's just not on his game in this scene. I think probably because he's playing off someone who isn't up to the performance in Becky, his love, and also the maitre d', or, you know, he's not really into the scene either. It's just a weird scene, and it doesn't do anything for the story of The Expanse at all. Therefore, it should be cut. That's just from an editing point of view. But also, it just doesn't work for the character, as you said. And to have it just out of the blue, he's got this woman on Earth that's been waiting for him to come back. It just doesn't, it doesn't advance his character. It doesn't make any sense for his character. And I can see easily why it was cut. And I'm a little bit puzzled as to why it was put in and filmed in the first place. When she says, if I find out you've got a girl in every spaceport, it almost felt like they were trying to make a reference to the impression that people have of Kirk, where it's just an alien woman everywhere. And of course, I think that's an impression people have of Kirk, not the reality, because he wasn't flying around sleeping with all the alien women. He was almost always getting the crew out of some kind of trouble, life-threatening situation, and doing it for that. But anyway, I think that scene didn't work. Now, the next scene is the one with Hoshi, where Archer goes in her quarters and she's packing, and he assumes that she's leaving the ship. And then he finds out that, in fact, she is staying. She's just packing some stuff up to send back to her mom before they head off to the Expanse. And before you give me your thoughts on that, I want to tell you the thought that passed through my head is Archer comes in and he asks, "How are your parents?" My mind immediately went to Hoshi's dad in Vanishing Point.
Yes,
and
yes.
And in my mind, I added, "Is your dad doing better mentally?" But then, of course, all that was in Hoshi's head. Archer didn't know about it, but that's the first thing I thought of. Like, how are your parents doing these days? But what do you think about the scene? Should this scene have been left in the episode?
I think that this scene was actually pretty good. Mm-hmm. And I had almost kind of wished it was in there. Part of that is because the way the scene references the storylines for Hoshi and how, you know, much she's come through. And I think this character has changed quite a bit from the first season. And the fact that, you know, she would be willing to go on this dangerous mission, I think is incredibly important. And so I love it. I love that that's the case. So I think they've done a really good job with this scene. And it is kind of sad that it had to get cut out just because of time. You know, this is the 42-minute episode time crunch that all shows were in at this point. And it's, you know, you miss a great quality, I think, character scene here that really worked. Again, and two, I think the beauty of it is in the way it works is because you get this sense almost that Archer is kind of like this older brother figure to Hoshi. He has that kind of feeling towards her in many ways, which I really enjoy that part of their relationship. You know, the fact that he talked her into coming in this mission in the first place, you know, kind of like an older brother might. And so I again, with all of that in mind, to me, this is a scene that just really does fit with the entire arc that we've had these characters on. And so, yeah, I wish it had stayed.
Yeah, same for me, for exactly the reasons that you say. It was true to her character. It actually means something for the character and for us as the viewer. I started to say it puts a bow on her character arc, but actually it's not, because it's just one step on a journey she's going to continue to go on.
Right.
But at this point, it does really highlight her growth from being hesitant to go on the mission to now wanting to stay. And not just being hesitant, but all the jitters that she had along the way, especially in the first half of the first season. It really shows how she's grown. And and also, it's well performed. It feels natural. It feels like the scene.
Yes.
It doesn't feel like something that's been crammed in like the restaurant scene does. It actually feels like it should be there. And it was just cut for time. And unfortunately, it contains important information that was cut. And the scene is 2 minutes and 14 seconds. So if I were editing the episode, I would find a way to shave 10 seconds here, 20 seconds there. Maybe I would shorten some of the chase scenes through the gas clouds so that I could fit this in, because I think that it actually contains important information for the story.
Yeah,
and
I agree.
And the story is, it doesn't, you know, destroy the story or anything, but I think the story is just a little bit weaker by not having this information in it.
Yeah. I agree with you.
All right. So what are your final thoughts and what's your rating for this one?
You know, I think that this is a pretty good episode. You know, I think that it's probably a good 4 out of 5 gaseous clouds surrounding the Expanse, because there are things I think that the episode could have done better. And mainly I think that at this point in television history, it would have been best as a two-parter to really kind of deal with everything they're trying to deal with. And I think it would have helped just expand the ability to get a better sense of, you know, what's happening on Earth. You know, that scene we didn't like with Archer, I think, does a great job of showing, you know, that it's rattled the entire world, right? You know, people aren't really going out to eat. They're staying home, you know? I think all of that kind of stuff would have been incredibly interesting, because also that will play into then in season four, right? The things that we see there. So I think just that kind of stuff overall would have been wonderful to have. But, you know, we didn't get it. That's okay. It's not as though the episode is really glaringly bad in any way, shape, or form. I actually think this is a pretty good episode with everything they're trying to do. And of course, it sets us on a brand new course, figuratively and literally, for the series. And so it'll be fun to dive into season three now. I'm looking forward to that. But Chris, what would you end up rating this one?
Well, final thoughts first. Pretty much mine echo yours. I remember watching this the first time, and I'll say that it's certainly grown on me over the years, and I've come to appreciate it a lot more. I think it's a good episode. They're trying to do too much, as we've talked about, but the core of what they're trying to do is good, and I think it's overall presented well, and it represents this turning point in the franchise that I think was a big risk at the time, and it did alienate some viewers for a little while, but I think a lot of those viewers have come back over the decades. And like me, I wasn't alienated at the time, but I will say I wasn't quite as looking forward to every week as I had been before. But I've come back around, and I think a lot of people have. So I'm going to give this episode 8 char-grilled lizards. And like you, I am looking forward to our new journey into season 3. And everyone, we would love to hear your thoughts on The Expanse as well. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. It's a closed group. It's just for listeners. So if you're joining for the first time, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You'll find a post on the timeline for this episode, and you can share your comments with Matthew and me and fellow listeners right there. You can also send us email if you like. Go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and choose Warp 5, and that message will break its way through the expanse clouds right over to Matthew and me by email. And of course, you can find us everywhere in social media. Our username everywhere is TrekFM. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we'd love to get those from you as well. Now, Matthew, when you're not hanging out in deserted Chinese restaurants in the middle of San Francisco, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me all over social media under the name MountRushing02. You can also find me here on the network in the 602 Club, talking about all the franchises outside of Star Trek that we love. Also doing Literary Treks, The Orb, Warp 5, The Artificial Tango, and Saddle Up. And then, of course, you can find me over on the Nerd Party Network with two shows. One's called Owl Post with Drea Kaufman, talking about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series. And then you'll find me on Aggressive Negotiations, talking about Star Wars with the great John Mills. But, Chris, when you're not trying to figure out, you know, how you're going to get your favorite egg drop soup while we're on this very long mission, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on the network, of course, doing all those shows with you, which you mentioned. And of course, you can find me on social media. My username everywhere is C. Brian Jones, the letter C and Brian with a Y. That is my username everywhere. And I'm on most platforms. Probably Twitter is still the place you'll find me the most responsive, but I'd love to hear from you anywhere you are. Now, if you'd like to help us keep all these rewatches and all the other shows that we're doing going, we could definitely use your help to find out how to support the network, how to get involved, how to help us keep the podcast coming to everyone. Please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. It takes a great deal of money to produce and distribute these podcasts, and we would not be here without the support of all of you. So thank you so much to everyone who is supporting us now. And if you're not, I do hope you'll consider doing so. Well, Matthew, we're going to swerve around those four clouds surrounding the expanse that you mentioned, go through that break where the fifth one should be, and go find those Zindi.
Chris, I can't wait to see what they look like, so let's go.